Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop and joined with me today is, well, as you've come to know him slightly in my ear and you guys hear him too. So I guess he's in yours too, is my producer, Manny. Manny.
Hey everyone, I'm back again.
We've got you mic'd and cammed up again. So this way those that are watching online can also see what producer Manny looks like. So we talked about it a little bit last time, but yeah, Manny kind of pops in every now and then and gives me a break. So I kind of appreciate that. But we've been trying to follow the data as much as we can as it relates to what everybody seems to enjoy the most on the podcast. And you guys, it's kind of what I've always assumed, which is you guys like to get to the point, get into the news. What are people talking about? What should you do? And I think that that's critical right now in the world of digital publishing, because you've got I wouldn't say unprecedented disruption, but for traditional publishers, and I think the majority of this audience, for sure, some of the most significant changes to what I think their businesses will look like over the next 5 to 10 years. But if you look at our space, I wouldn't panic quite too much in terms of is this going to be a job, in quotes, or is this going to be a business that needs to exist? Publishing has been needed since, you know, you can go back before, you know, modern era. You can go back, and by modern era, I mean, you know, in the last couple centuries, and you can go all the way back to when they had stone tablets. They had stone tablets because, yeah, somebody had information and other people wanted it. So you have to write that down. So yeah, I would say in that sense, publishing is still going to remain quite healthy. Now, what it looks like, I think, is potentially going to change quite a bit. And you know, a good example of that, I think, is this article that producer Manny actually found. It's from SEO Roundtable, but it's being discussed everywhere. If you're not aware of it, I'd be surprised as a publisher by the time this comes out, which will be another day or two. Yeah, it should be on your radar. And it's that Google Search now has a From Publishers You Follow section. So you can kind of think of this a little bit like whenever Facebook pages really had their reach clamped down, and all of a sudden Facebook needed basically your users or your page followers to mark that they wanted your stuff to be prioritized in their feed. And there's been untold amounts of various, you know, platforms that have followed suit over time. But the new From Publishers You Follow section in Google Search, publishers are largely encouraged to get their followers on news.google.com to follow them. Publishers that are concerned about potential drops in organic traffic have something, I think, fairly valid there to think about. And I'll get into that in a minute. But this is really where Google's AI powered search, you know, the search generative experience, SGE, they love acronyms. God, they do. But this is where you're going to see that start to come into play. And what it's supposed to do is have an adaptation or personalization, something that they were always against in search results, to include unique content for direct reader engagement. It may potentially disrupt things like affiliate marketing and, obviously ad revenue for publishers that are reliant on that, obviously. And then legal and political factors affect the outcomes of these things as well. So we could see a lot of things come of this over time, whether it's Google's, you know, pending, you know, charges with, I think it's some of the states and the attorney generals there regarding, you know, antitrust, or just in general, how we interact with AI on the web. I think that there could be many political and legal factors that, you know, the survival of this particular adaptation could be affected by. But that being said, I do want to come back to the, you know, the revenue drop, and then the, you know, the disruption of ad revenue and affiliate marketing, because, you know, this is something where the first thing I think of is the Facebook page reach. Now, can you still make money off of Facebook traffic like you could, you know, 13, 14 years ago? I mean, realistically, you could. It's just way less common. You know, 10, 15 years ago, this was a strategy. I mean, you would build a Facebook page rather quickly, a massive following, and then drive them back to your website. Typically, the sites that were able to do that really well, really quickly, it was a lot of like cute cat video type things. If some of you can remember back, and I remember one particular publisher that I knew, they actually had Facebook. They had some kind of copyright request or something like that for a video on their page that they had actually licensed. And Facebook took their page down, and it shuttered a $30,000 a month business they had. It was a pretty nice little side venture they had. And I just remember talking to the publisher and them being like, it's crazy to me that Facebook can just take my page away, and this is my sole source of income. And, you know, what do I do now? And last I talked to them, they were still trying to get in contact with somebody at Facebook. And as you know, if you're listening to this podcast, getting a hold of anybody at any social media company is not easy. I'm looking at you, X/Twitter. But yeah, producer Manny, before we got on the show, you mentioned that it's similar to YouTube, which maybe is a more appropriate, I guess, sort of comparison. This, you know, the from publishers you follow section being a little bit more like subscribers in YouTube.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard a lot of YouTubers that I watch where they say, hey, make sure to subscribe, just because at this point, even on your subscription feed, YouTube won't always give you the people that you're hoping to see or videos that you want to watch. I think they're doing that with just their search engine. So now if you're a publisher, it's very important to make sure to have your audience know that you should follow me to make sure you get all updates from my content, just because unless you're searching for me directly, you might not see the content come up in your feed anymore.
And I think, to me, you know, like when you mentioned that, it kind of, I think maybe sometimes I'm a little bit jaded by this, by the industry and by big tech. And so I do think that there may be a, not just a silver lining here, but maybe an opportunity and maybe something that's overall good for the health of publishing. So bear with me here, because I imagine there's many that are listening to this are like, how can this be good, Tyler? You've lost me and now I don't listen to the show anymore. Wait, for those that are left, let me just paint this picture for you. A couple weeks ago, I'd mentioned that the advantage that I felt that YouTubers had compared to, you know, like textual-based web publishers, in that they, I felt like they had a much more direct understanding of sort of their audience and what their audience liked. So it was much easier for them to create the content that they needed to create to continue to engage and grow their audience. Publishers oftentimes look at Google Analytics and usually are not looking at it very well and don't understand that Google Analytics is mostly incorrect in terms of the information. Not that it's not directionally accurate, just that the data itself is actually, it's a good portion made up or, just not accurate because of implementation anyways. So, and not only that, but the information is filtered through Google search. So if you make content that Google likes, they'll show it to your audience. What if you make content that your audience would love, but Google just, you don't rank for it? It sucks, you know? And it's one of those things to where it's like, it disconnects you from the one thing that like potentially allows you to grow, which is you're making content that's on demand. So supply and demand. And with this, at least now you can sort of benefit from the same thing that YouTubers have, which is you can develop subscribers. You can get people that want to come to your site specifically. And Google, this is the first time I've ever seen them make a decision, Manny, to be honest, that sort of like allows you to cut them out to a certain extent. I mean, even though we're still talking about search results and maybe you know, it's kind of more like a favorite or something like that. You know, this does create this opportunity for, you know, you to see all the sites you follow and even go to them by name. I've yet to see Google over time do anything that takes away from like making all the results seem almost generic. Like Google is giving you the answers to the content versus the publisher. Can you think of any other examples like that?
Nothing comes straight to mind that will pull people away from the platform. Even like Facebook, if you ever try to click away to go to the actual publisher's site, it puts a screen in front of you where it says, are you sure you want to leave Facebook? So this does seem unprecedented. Another thing that is kind of concerning to me, and I wonder if this is just a reactionary thing to AI, experts predict that this could happen as soon as the fall. I mean, that's a month away.
Yeah. And I think if you're a publisher, the way that I would look at this is that Google search seems to be kind of pushing in the direction of, you know, catering to publishers or sites that are able to market and sort of adapt their content and things like that to be a lot more like a YouTuber or like a, you know, Instagram influencer or something like that. And that may, I know that that's not going to be a super popular piece of, ecosystem direction for a lot of the publishers. It's not going to be palatable to our listeners, I don't think, or people rely on organic search, but I'm telling you, this is a big opportunity. Because realistically, you know, Google a couple years ago really was pushing AMP, and AMP, in my opinion, is the exact opposite of this. So instead of liking individual publishers, AMP really stripped down a lot of the brand components and simplified websites, especially early on because it was very limited, although now it's as bloated as regular HTML. But it became something that, like, Google was serving results from their cache. That just meant that essentially you were still on google.com, and I know that they changed some of this, but this was the original idea that basically Google is going to be a newsfeed and you gave it content and it didn't even go to your website anymore. And you could just use Google ads on there. No problem. Right. But I think herein you're finding basically the exact opposite, where Google's becoming, you know, really just a middleman that's, you know, allowing people to locate content easier. It's sort of the original idea behind Google. And to me, it signals kind of a little bit of a return to the roots. So I would pay close attention to the types of publishers and then some of the strategy used by modern YouTubers, because I definitely think that there is a major path for success here and something that's ultimately maybe going to help you build a moat as a publisher. Now, are you going to have to adapt and are you going to have to change? And will it be harder for some than others? Yes, but it's possible. I can assure you it's possible. Next up, we had a report on AI, and this one comes from What's New in Publishing. Any media company banking on legal intervention to protect copyright might be disappointed. Now, this is something we talked a little bit last week when we were talking about watermarks. But this is really about generative AI adoption and sort of like the rate at which it's eclipsing, you know, like even the use of something like smartphones and tablets, et cetera. And so you've got media firms that are sharing sort of their AI experiments that they've done. ChatGPT is you know, iterating on steps to transform businesses. It's being implemented in a lot of places. A lot of places have banned it, actually. And now you're having, you know, sort of like groups like the News Media Alliance advocating for AI compensation. You've got all these different, you know, employees and people that have worked for some of these companies developing AI. They're being subpoenaed, and, you know, there's litigation that's already starting to take place. And so you're starting to see the adoption of AI in just about every part of a business. But I've even seen recently where companies have banned the use of AI because they're concerned about where the information even comes from. So, you know, if you're a research company and you're, you know, using ChatGPT to even just do some basic junior level research, you know, analysis, or have a research assistant do that for you, and you're a public company, you know, at what point do we learn that, like, you have an employee that, you know, used ChatGPT and it used the model or information from someplace else that decides that they're going to enact, you know, a civil lawsuit against your business because, you know, they claim that you stole their something of theirs that's proprietary. And by using ChatGPT, you technically have an employee that did. This is the type of thing that you're going to have to consider. And I think there's nobody that's at the tip of the spear quite like digital publishers are. So ChatGPT launched in November 2022. And, you know, it's aiming for 77.8 million users in the next 2 years. So I don't know, Manny, this was one that I kind of wanted to pick your brain about a little bit more last week when we talked about, you know, watermarks and things like that. But as somebody that's, created a lot of, especially video and visual media, what's long been considered something that's a little bit more copyrightable, you know, how does this strike you? Like, what is your intuition on, you know, I guess, like, are you afraid of this? Is this something, or is this something where it's just sort of like, what can I even do?
I think I'm of two mindsets with this. First is the reactionary one, where it's like, you know, holy crap, like, I can't believe it's blowing up as much as it is. Like I think back to smartphones, I got my first smartphone in like 2011 and the iPhone came out like 2006, 2007.
Yeah, vintage iPhone.
And even then, older family members took several years after that to even adopt like a smartphone. And within a year, we have almost 78 million users who are using AI. So then after that, you know, once that thought settles down, I think, okay, it's whoever is able to adapt is who is going to be ending up ahead. And we've been saying this for weeks, like if you're a publisher and you're not using AI, you're falling behind. You need to adapt now, adapt early, and take advantage while you can.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the example that I would give on this is that I think that you can be, you don't want to be the person that's shot in the street first. I think that you don't have to worry about that as a publisher, because I think that'll be, if it's going to be a publisher, like in a significant way, it's going to be, you know, one of these major brand publishers, probably something more like a Quora, somebody like that, that's been very active in embedding basically just ChatGPT to like generate user-based content. Which I think that's ultimately something that's going to really harm them. But nevertheless, I think the people that are going to have to worry about, you know, major consequences for, you know, AI stuff are really those that are creating the AI itself, not the people that are using it. Because here's where I would create, you know, maybe an example that people would be familiar with. If you guys remember Napster, it's not here anymore. So you can think of that as sort of like the ChatGPT. But the music industry folks that thought like, hey, we're going to fight back against the streaming thing. We want people to buy albums. You know, that's a losing battle. And I think getting too focused on fear and of consequences and trying to fight back against this stuff, I think we've seen enough times throughout history that you don't want to be that one. You want to be the Spotify. You want to be the music industry and the labels that were like, hey, cat's out of the bag. We got to roll with the punches. That's how you survive. And look, most of the major record labels that, you know, were around, you know, 30 years ago, they're still here. A lot of them not, but largely the models and the people and the industry, even some of the labels themselves, it's largely the same company. They've changed the names. But I think that that's probably the comparison that I have here. So I would really caution people and maybe not using AI or using it in a limited fashion out of caution. I think out of not understanding, I think that there's always that sort of like adoption curve. You mentioned Manny with the phones. But realistically, as a publisher, you need to be trying to adopt this stuff. And I wouldn't be afraid. I think it's scary to think that you would wait around for clarity while the rest of the industry passes you by. And ultimately, the consequences are reserved for those that are making it. Because I do think that this is kind of one of those things where it's like, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to go after every single person that downloaded, you know, a Metallica song? Probably not, right? That's probably the best comparison that I can give on this.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm the Global Director of Publisher Success at eZilliq, and I'm here to tell you what's new with the Support Dashboard. The Support Dashboard makes it quick and easy to help you find answers to questions that you may have and get you back to creating content very quickly. The new layout is designed to increase accessibility. You have access to any of your open tickets, you can contact our live chat agents, and you have direct access to the knowledge base for any of your questions. We've also implemented a light mode and a dark mode for your visual preferences. Additionally, you'll be able to register for any of our upcoming webinars right from your dashboard. You'll be able to view any past webinars, the latest news and releases, and access to our blog, all without needing to be logged in. If you still didn't find what you're looking for, you can suggest an article, review our development docs, or submit feedback. Be sure to check out the new Support Dashboard by using the link in the description.
Which brings us sort of to our last topic when we start talking about major brands, and some that have stuck around and some that haven't. Although Threads is still here for now, a recent report by Adweek and Search Engine Land showed that social media, so it's called a social media report, brands face Threads fatigue as app loses nearly 80% of daily active users. Well, the listener to this podcast, I'm much too humble of a person to say, I told you so. But I just said it anyway. So Mark Zuckerberg's Meta also laid off 21,000 employees so far this year. Now it's reportedly hiring many of them back, although I'd argue that many of them are not the same engineers, but different ones, which we can kind of get into in a moment. And then Twitter lowers the eligibility threshold for ads, ad revenue sharing among their users. So that's a really interesting one I want to get into as well. So Meta's Threads, Manny, we talked about this on the show probably, you know, a month ago whenever Threads was first dropped. And look, just so happened we were kind of right about this one. What do you think?
I'm not big into gambling, but I kind of am bummed I didn't put any money down on this one when you said it. You kind of called it. Everybody jumped on board, and now, you know, a lot of brands are slowing down how much content they're even posting there.
Yeah.
Companies like Anthropology, Wendy's, Rare Beauty just are not posting there anymore. I think they're seeing it as more of like, it was kind of like a fad. It was here for a second and then it's gone.
It really felt like that too from you know, I'd called out, I think, early on the fact that, you know, the way that they were even reporting it from a PR perspective, there was no confidence or no stories or no substance that they were pushing related to the why people liked the platform. It was all about the number of people that had basically created accounts. And, you know, like, I think that the majority of this audience, you know, whether or not they're plugged into, like, you know, software as a service based industry, you know, talking points and different things like that. But like, everybody knows you can get, you know, basically user accounts created in a billion ways, but getting daily active users is a completely different thing. And so seeing that drop off of 80%, again, it's like, it's Instagram people that don't use Twitter for a reason, or, you know, have a Twitter for a reason, that don't want to basically take their Instagram audience, which is, you know, their social circles and things like that, and then, you know, interact with them in a Twitter experience. They use those things separately, or they don't use them separately. They use one or the other, and for a reason. And I think that seemed very obvious to me. It didn't make sense to begin with. And I do think that there's a certain amount of, like, Facebook was going to do this for all kinds of different ulterior motives, no matter what. But this was a very predictable outcome. And I know that Meta is hiring back a lot of engineers, but I don't think that they're going to be the same engineers that they've laid off throughout the year. And it's because, you know, they thought the metaverse was going to be here. They thought, you know, this is going to be a wave. We're going to take advantage. We're going to lead the way in, you know, augmented reality based or virtual reality based, you know, web interactions and whatnot. And if anybody's going to pioneer that now, it definitely looks like it'll be Apple, and it might be a while. Cost prohibitive, you know, et cetera. But realistically, if you look at what Meta is doing now, it seems like they really want to make an investment in sort of like what the future of social media is, how that integrates with AI, and how they can stay on the forefront. And that's a very different type of engineer. And I would say that is primarily where they need to invest. It's been a long time since they innovated in the social space. I mean, really, it was Facebook. It was very popular and it took off. And then everything else has been acquisition based. They bought Instagram, they bought WhatsApp. You know, realistically, you let me put my VC hat on, I'm probably going around to Meta and I'm saying, like, who's out there now that's made something that's unique, that's cool, that we believe in, and like, let's buy them, even if it's maybe not the world's most popular thing in the world. Like, one thing that we've been able to prove with Meta is that they can steal technologies like Reels and things like that and get their users to adopt them if they like it. The problem is again, they haven't innovated on their own in a really long time. So they should go out and find something that's fairly unique, that maybe has some traction with a much younger audience, and see if they can't push that to their Instagram or Facebook users and drive some adoption there, because then they actually would have something that they could feel good about investing in and feel good about the future. But that's just my opinion. Manny, what do you think? Am I being too hard on Meta here?
No, I think you make some great points. Personally, I wish they brought back Farmville, maybe a little bit more user-friendly, and send me some coins so I can plant some more crops. But I think it's definitely they're seeing a big shift in the company right now. I think that them hiring people back is trying to get more focus on certain projects. I don't know if they're going to be pivoting. I don't know if they're going to be staying on the same thing. But I think that really goes to show that, like, hey, we let go of a lot of people, but we need these people back.
Yeah, I really liked Meta's conviction on the metaverse a couple years ago. I didn't see it then, but I like the bold sort of interest. And we kind of talked about how companies like that make decisions and about why they're ultimately always disrupted because of that. It's sort of impossible not to be. But with Meta in particular now, I sort of am like, you know, I see their failure stick out to me more because at least with a conviction on something like the metaverse, yeah, you might be wrong, but if you're right and you're right, like, that conviction will keep you in business for a long period of time. And it's not to say they can't recover. I mean, Google did this, you know, 10 years ago, they, with Google Plus and different things like that, they tried to basically add all these extra things onto search and try to get people to use a bunch of things that they didn't want to use. And ultimately it was things like Gmail and Google Workspace that, like, you know, gave them a resurgence and sort of like relevance beyond just their search engine. And Meta can do the same. The biggest thing that I worry about with Meta is they seem to really struggle with a sense of identity. Are they Meta? Because they kind of ditched the whole metaverse thing. And then you've got Facebook, which people, I think of as old, and that's who Meta really is. And then you've got Instagram and you have WhatsApp. And now you have Threads. So I'm just struggling to see who is Meta and what are they. Stark contrast to Twitter, or the X formerly known as Twitter, because they seem to really, Elon seems to have a very clear idea of what he wants X to be. And for better or for worse, they've certainly drove in that direction very quickly. And it's losing money by all accounts, quite a bit of it. However, the daily active users continue to rise. And I think that there's a lot of little sort of aberrations related to why that is. But I honestly don't see that slowing down significantly. So you now have X saying that they're going to lower the threshold for verified creators to be able to share revenue on the platform or get tips and different things like that. The monetization features that were once only available to people that, I think it was like, I forget what it was, but I think it's 10,000 followers. And do you know what the criteria was, Manny? Do you remember?
I don't recall. If you give me a second, I can pull it up real quick.
It wasn't that hard to check like a handful of the boxes, but I do think that there was one particular like requirement that I thought was rather high or I guess preventative for a lot of publishers. But I like this a lot because it incentivizes people to make content for audiences for the sake of making money. And so, you know, with that, in the same way that if you can imagine how many, you know, sites wouldn't have made it or wouldn't have started if they couldn't, you know, make a little bit of money in the beginning. Because if you have this really high threshold to start, sometimes you just want to see, like, can I build an audience? Can I make money, you know, working on content like this? And or even you might not even have that as an intention. But the second you see that you can, you're like, the wheels start turning. You go, oh, wait a minute here. You know, like maybe this is something I want to invest more of my time in. And I think that you saw that with YouTube. I think you've seen it in a lot of different things, but I like the incentive being there, and I'm always pro, you know, anything that lowers the barrier to entry for people to make money from the content that they produce, I think the better. I hate that social media companies, you know, make a fortune off of ads, when all the users are there because of other users generating content. That is the big secret of big tech, that they've found ways to have people give them content or products for free, and then they monetize it and they share a very small amount.
That being said, it's still a massive a number that you have to reach in order to be a verified creator. They went from 15 million impressions in the past 3 months down to 5 million. So yeah. It's still, you know,
it's pretty considerable. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge reduction in terms of percentage. You know, it's a drop of about 66%. But realistically, I still think that for X, that tells me that they're still a little concerned about like providing that incentive at two. What's the word I'm looking for? I guess at a reach level that's too low, because I think that they're worried about more and more spammy sort of like, I mean, it's kind of how SEO ruined the web in a lot of ways. It's like you ended up with a lot of like cookie cutter content that ends up being, you know, the same. And I think Twitter already has concerns about like data storage costs and things like that. And the last thing they need is a bunch of web spam clogging up Twitter with people creating the same things to make a quick buck. So I do get that decision, and I would expect that, you know, if you are a publisher and you see an avenue here for yourself on Twitter, the only thing that I would caution you on is that Twitter, if they've proven anything, it's volatile recently. So I'd be really nervous if, you know, I really like the idea of companies trying to find ways that they can allow people to build their business on top of their business. You can think of this like an app store or Salesforce who allowed third parties to like make apps for Salesforce, and the people that were the app makers, you know, a lot of those ended up becoming these giant companies because of it. You know, if you're somebody that sees an avenue here, I'd be very like apprehensive about trying to start a business with that is going to make money on Twitter, because, you know, Twitter might say tomorrow that, hey, we're removing all revenue sharing with people. And none of us would be surprised. We'd probably be puzzled, which we have been in the past about X. And you'd be disappointed if you were a publisher as well, making money from it. But, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise. And that's always something I think about quite a bit whenever I invest a lot of time and energy in something that's new, especially a platform, is what are the chances that even if this goes well, that like it disappears? You know, am I going to buy a Sega Dreamcast here, and the next thing you know, like, it's got like 10 games. Shout out to all the people that remember Sega Dreamcast. But yeah, I think that sort of summarizes a lot of the topics that we have today. A lot of big tech and focused, a lot of focus on AI. But I don't know, Manny, what is your sense of sort of how this year has evolved? I feel like things have never moved faster, but I feel like where we were in January and where we were now, I think just the ideas that people have about AI and sort of like the future of the web have probably shifted a lot already.
I think so. I think initially everyone kind of, you know, put their panics on. But as the year has gone on, people have adopted AI a lot more. So they're a little bit more open to the idea. But there's still a lot of concern. So hopefully, yeah, you know, we get some more clarity within the next year or so as some new laws come into play and see how that affects everyone's business and just workflow in general.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that that's the reason why, you know, hopefully you listen to this podcast, is that's sort of what we're trying to provide here, is as things change, you know, when we were starting to talk about bringing back the podcast from, you know, we'd had a popular podcast on publishing a couple of years ago. I couldn't believe that people wanted to listen to me talk more than they have to. But the thing that stuck out to me is where I thought that we could add value in an area that, you know, largely I don't see anybody else really talking at an expert level about, sort of like the news that's happening each week. Because I thought, man, we'd have content for forever, because right now the way that things are changing and the way that things are disrupted, you have to pay attention. And the thing that struggles, creates a struggle, I think, a lot of times for publishers, and I think a lot of our audience, is the fact that they're independent. And so, you know, you get the news and the information, but you kind of have to parse through it and go, well, what does this mean? Can I make the right decisions? And even if it's something that, you know, maybe I'm comfortable with, you know, the way things are headed, you know, sometimes it's nice to have a perspective of somebody that has, you know, a view of maybe a broader, you know, the broader market, and being able to sort of discern for people, you know, this may not be as bad or as good as maybe it presents itself. So hopefully you enjoy it. If you do, it'd be great if you leave us a review on wherever you listen to the podcast. You can leave us questions and I'll answer them live on air. We haven't had a question in a minute, so go for it. I will say your name and whatever you like. But I love getting questions from the audience. Super helpful, guides the show. And you can do that at publisherlab.org. And I think that's it for today. Thanks for listening to another episode of The Publisher Lab.